never chalks off zeal or enthusiasm like that. He recognized what was in Peter's heart, and that's why Jesus said to Peter, come. And again, don't forget that Jesus issued that invitation. And if the Lord had not bid Peter come to him, Peter wouldn't have tried it. And the Lord never invites anybody into danger, and he never invites anybody to expose himself to risk. And whenever you find Jesus encouraging anybody, it's because it can be accomplished. You never find him encouraging anybody to try the impossible. On the contrary, whenever Jesus sees anything in our lives that's good and worthy and noble, he draws it out. He encourages it. He strengthens it. And he sees the faith and the love in the heart of Peter, and he wants to encourage that, to draw it out, to get Peter to express it. And I believe it was like that too. So that you don't find a rebuke for Peter here. Later on, when they're both in the boat with the others, and I've no doubt that Peter's very full of disappointment because he'd failed in that way, Jesus didn't rebuke him for asking to be allowed to step over the side of the boat. Jesus didn't say to him, now I hope you've learned your lesson. No, he said, oh ye of little faith, why did you doubt? And I can see the tenderness and the love in the eyes of Jesus as he speaks to Peter. He's saying, Peter, you could have done it. You could have made it. Why did you doubt? Just how do you think Jesus looked on Peter's attempt at that time? Well, if you have children, and some of you have children of your own, and some of you will have your own children eventually, I'm sure you can all understand how parents feel about their own children. You know, when you see that baby crawling around the room, and eventually it gets up and it holds onto the couch or the chair, you know, and it's desperately anxious to, eh? You know what I mean, don't you? But what do? You say, come on, and you hold your hands out, and you're delighted, aren't you? It's a tremendous thrill for any parent to see the child make the first feeble steps. All right, okay, good. But you see, right. At least now John has the privilege. Well, I think that's exactly how Jesus saw it when Peter was wanting to step over the side and walk to him. What else but love and faith would have put this idea into Peter's mind? And Jesus was encouraging the steps of faith on this occasion. Right, like the parent holding out his arms to the hesitant child, like, come on. You come, you can do it. Again, would you have tried it? Honestly, I've thought about this a great deal from time to time, and I don't know that I would have even wanted to try it. And at least I have got to give Peter the credit for having this tremendous faith in Jesus. So, whenever you read this story about Peter wanting to walk on the sea, don't look upon it as a warning against rashness or lack of faith. It's anything but that. Peter's impulse was good, his heart was right, and that's why Jesus encouraged him. But let's have a look at Jesus before we wind up this. One or two other lessons that I think can be learned from this. I think in it you see the kind of thing that Jesus is always doing. Jesus is always doing what is humanly impossible. The thing that's impossible to people like you and me. His walking on that sea, I suppose you could say, is symbolic of the way that he always acted. The Sea of Galilee, put it like this, the Sea of Galilee is not the only sea that Jesus walked on, figuratively speaking. Nothing can harm him. No danger can overpower him. No storm can hold him. And when the waves are beating high and the wind is threatening to overturn the boat or swamp the boat, Jesus keeps on coming, walking calmly through the storm. That's the kind of person that he is. I think that you could actually take this historic event, this actual event, and turn it into a picture of life itself. You fill in the background, first of all, in your minds. There's the darkness and the storm and the sea. And then set right in the middle of that picture, this grand, strong, calm figure of Jesus. Well, you know, it's the kind of picture that's inspired painters and poets all down the centuries. Because it represents Jesus in all the storms of human life. Your life, and my life too, for that matter. And Jesus is there, constantly walking on the water, unhindered, unharmed by the storm. He goes where men have never gone before. He does what men have never done before. For example, he came into the world to teach men about God. And in the teaching that Jesus gave about God, he went where men had never gone before. Because until Jesus came, nobody in the whole of human history had ever revealed God the way that Jesus did. Nobody ever thought to speak of God as the God of love in the way that Jesus... You think of the gods that men made for themselves in the course of history. Cruel gods. Gods of war. Lustful gods. Vengeful gods. Immoral gods, if you read the Greek mythology. But nobody at any time had ever conceived of a God of love. Not even the greatest philosophers, the greatest minds the world had ever known until Jesus came, had ever dared to tell men that God loved them. Oh, it's no doubt that there's no doubt that they hoped that it might be true. The greatest minds the world had ever known longed to believe that the one who created everything was a loving God, but they couldn't be sure. It wasn't until Jesus came that he revealed that the one who created everything was a loving God. John 3:16, for God so loved the world. And Jesus says, I'll teach them that the will of God can be obeyed. That God doesn't make impossible demands. He says, I'll set them an example. And you remember that Satan did his utmost to pull Jesus down in that respect. There were storms of temptation, but Jesus walked through the storms of temptations because he said, I do always the things which are well-pleasing unto the Father. Again, you think of the way that he called the outcasts, something that nobody had ever done before, and certainly something that nobody in his own time would ever have done. I call sinners, not the righteous, he said. And regardless of the opposition, as we've already seen in this study, Jesus went to the outcast, the sin-stained, the fallen, the unwanted, and he did something that nobody else could have done without running the risk of becoming contaminated. He was the friend of sinners, and at the same time he was the sinless one. Now, these are some of the things that you find in the life of Jesus. I suppose you could call them miracles in a way, because that's what they were. But let's come back to Peter for just one minute. Peter says, bid me come. And he stepped over the side, and he did it. And that's when he began to sink. He took his eyes off Jesus. He looked at the waves instead of looking at the Lord, and he began to sink. But you know, the few steps that he took show you what he could have done if his faith had been stronger. Yes, he failed that night, and he failed again. You remember later on when the night was even darker, when he betrayed Jesus. But don't ever overlook that Peter succeeded, because he walked hand in hand with Jesus and they got together in the boat. That's something we often overlook. We see Peter sinking, but we often forget that Jesus stretched out his hand and lifted Peter up. And together, hand in hand, they walked back to the boat and they stepped inside it. So let's use this incident as a means of strengthening our own faith. And I'm taking this line this morning because I think it's important. Things that might otherwise seem impossible or beyond our reach become possible when Jesus is present. How many times do you reckon Peter had been on that same sea? Yet how many times do you suppose it had occurred to him to walk on the water? Not very often. What made the difference? The presence of Jesus. I don't think Peter would ever have dreamed about walking on the sea if Jesus hadn't been there. And the second lesson is that nothing is too difficult if you're doing it at the command of Jesus. If James or John had challenged Peter to walk on the sea, I don't think he would have entertained it for one minute. He would have said, "You think I'm crazy?" He would have dismissed it as an impossibility. But because Jesus was there, what was usually impossible became possible. When Jesus said, "Come," Peter was ready to make the attempt. And there's a third lesson. Even though Peter began to sink, when his faith failed him, at least he knew where to turn to. Because he said, "Lord, save me." And he didn't for a moment imagine that Jesus wasn't able to help him. And Jesus helped. And they walked back to the boat. So instead of being held up as a warning, I would suggest that we ought to find an example in Peter, in particular in these days, and particularly when some of you are thinking anxiously about this business of what you're going to do in the summertime. Far too often we're afraid to try anything great, anything heroic. Jesus has come, and often we're afraid to venture out, aren't we? We cling to the boat. Jesus says, "Follow me," and we're inclined to hold back. We tell ourselves that Jesus said, "Well, I've given you an example that you should follow in my steps." But then we tell ourselves that the life of Jesus is exceptional. It's miraculous. It's impossible. And so we leave his way and we go our own way. But no Christian has ever said, "Lord, bid me come to thee," without getting the same answer that Peter got. Come. And I think this is what Jesus is looking for. Jesus is looking for commitment. Jesus is looking for the venture of faith in our lives. Jesus is looking for us to step over the side of the boat with faith in him, in the knowledge that he'll respond and he'll help us. Now, have any comments on that? How are we doing for time? Oh, it's too late. It's 20 minutes to 11. Let's stop and have a cup of something. That's right. Come across the Sea of Galilee on that occasion. Have a look at John 6 and 17. John 6 and 17. Where did they start out to go? Perhaps that's the question. To Capernaum. Look at Mark 5. Mark 6:45. Where did they land? Well, that's Matthew's account, isn't it? But Mark 6:45 says he made his disciples get into a boat to go to the other side, to Bethsaida. But as Peter points out in Matthew 14 verse 34, they actually arrived at Gennesaret. Yes, that's right, but they set out to Bethsaida. Mark and Matthew go together on that. They arrived at Gennesaret. So that was not really the original place to which they had set out. Actually, this is, you don't see too clearly here, but Gennesaret is actually the name given to a plain
that's about 5 miles long, just below Capernaum, and about 3 miles deep. It's a very fertile place on that northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Most of the shoreline of Galilee is extremely rocky, and I think I mentioned once before that one of the reasons why the sudden storms arose on the sea was that the winds were funneled down the gullies from the mountains onto the surface of the sea, so that in a matter of seconds, literally seconds, the sea can become a raging torrent. But on this section here, the northwestern shore, there is the Plain of Gennesaret, as it's called, and this is really what we're talking about now. Fertile, with vineyards, they grow figs, olives, walnuts, wildflowers, flowering shrubs, and the actual shore itself is made of white shells from the lake, protected by cliffs at either end, so that it would make a very nice place to have a picnic, a nice place for Jesus to take his disciples away to rest a while. And that was the original intention, you remember. It could have been a fine place to rest, and unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. Now, remember that it's barely daylight. It's the morning watch from 3 to 6 o'clock in the morning. And they're on shore. But it's not very long before the news of their presence gets around. The people recognize them. Look at Mark 6:53. And when they had crossed, they came to the land of Gennesaret, and moored to the shore. When they got out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him and ran about the whole neighborhood and began to bring sick people on their pallets to any place where they heard he was. So, Jesus has no sooner landed than the crowd is gathering again, so that it adds weight to the statement already made that there was no time so much as to eat. There were many comings and goings, and they didn't find any rest at all. Both Mark and Matthew give you the picture of the people bringing streams of sick people out to be cured by Jesus, and he moved from the shore into their towns and villages, and the marketplaces became open-air hospitals while Jesus worked with the sick people, and people pressed on him, we're told, to touch the border of his garment. Notice in the last verse of chapter 6, whenever he came in the villages, cities, or country, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and besought him that they might even touch the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. I wonder where they got that idea from. The woman, certainly. Of course, they would certainly have heard about the way in which this woman who'd been sick for 12 long years had been cured when she grasped the borders of the fringe of the garment of Jesus, and it worked for them too. And yet, Jesus had his enemies as well as his friends, and that's what follows next in this passage. He was a rallying point for both enemies and friends. Not only did the people come to be healed, we're told here, but chapter 7 begins that the Pharisees gathered together to him. Now, they haven't bothered him too much. As we've seen, he's working up in Galilee and not down in Judea, in Jerusalem. Some of the Pharisees from the region have on an earlier occasion come to listen to him, to criticize him, and they're there again. Remember that this is going to be the year of opposition. And now they've come up to their old tricks again, probing and pressing and questioning and maneuvering to try to get Jesus in a difficult situation. Anything at all, it seems, that could force Jesus into a corner was tried by these men. Anything that could be criticized, they pounced on in their endeavor to trap him into making a damaging statement of some kind. Now, in this case, as chapter 7 shows, they come questioning concerning him concerning the business of washing hands, eating with unwashed hands. They've probably seen Jesus during their travels from place to place, and they've noticed that the disciples took their bread for their meal without stopping to go through the ritualistic washing of hands. Now, there are two points to notice here. First, the bread at this time was possibly some of the bread that had been taken up from the fragments, from the feeding of the 5,000. You remember that Jesus had instructed them to take up the fragments that were left, that nothing be wasted. They were meant to be used. Oh, it is an assumption, but I think it's a logical assumption. I don't think Jesus was on an anti-litter campaign.
No, but the Pharisees really didn't want a miracle at all.
I'm sure the Pharisees would get, you can't stop 5,000 people talking about a miracle. I'm quite sure that the people would soon get to know about the miracle, because the Pharisees undoubtedly would have heard of what Jesus had been doing. After all, if news of the miracles that Jesus had been performing away from home got to Nazareth, you can guarantee that the Pharisees would have their informers keeping an eye on Jesus and sending reports as to the activities of this man. I don't think there's any doubt at all that the Pharisees, like the ordinary people, would know of the miracles Jesus was performing. The point I'm making is this, that when Jesus said, gather up the fragments that nothing be lost, he literally meant that nothing be wasted. So the pieces of the bread that were left over were meant to be used. Remember that Jesus and his disciples didn't have a limitless source of money. They were dependent upon charity, upon the gifts of others, and consequently Jesus was extremely frugal and economic in matters like this. Although he had the power to conjure up food whenever he so desired, Jesus, as we've already seen, never used that power for his own selfish ends, his own personal ends. So that the 12 baskets full of fragments would have been carried up. 12 baskets full. How many disciples were there? So that each one would probably be carrying one of the baskets, his own satchel with food in it. However, be that as it may, the fact is that the Pharisees have noticed that the disciples of Jesus are eating with hands that are, according to this record, defiled, Mark says, and explains it by meaning unwashed. Now, let me stress the fact that this is a ritualistic washing of hands. It's not that Jesus didn't believe in hygiene, not at all. Jesus did believe in hygiene, but this was a ritualistic, a washing of hands with a religious significance. The Pharisees had made a law where the law made no law, so to speak. The explanation that Mark gives is there in verses 3 and 4, and when you remember that Mark is making this record for the benefit of non-Jewish readers, this is why in parenthesis at verse 3 you read, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, observing the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they purify themselves, and there are many other traditions which they observe, the washing of cups and pots and vessels of bronze. Now you think about this. They don't eat unless they wash themselves. Now the idea of that is that when they come from the marketplace, they may have brushed against somebody who's unclean in the course of getting through the crowd in the marketplace. And so when they get home, the first thing that these very Orthodox Jews do is to ceremonially wash themselves of any defilement they may have unconsciously contacted by coming into contact with somebody in the marketplace. And when it comes to cups, as Mark points out here, and plates, when a Pharisee was offered food or offered a cup with which to drink, he always thought, now the last lips to have touched this cup may have been the lips of an unclean person. Or the last hands to have handled this plate may have been the hands of somebody ceremonially unclean. Therefore, as a precaution, the Pharisee would go through the ritualistic washing of his hands, or the washing, and the washing of the cup, and the washing of the plate. Now, where's the authority for this?
No. There's nothing in the scriptures to authorize it. It wasn't required by the Old Testament. It was simply one of the things that the Pharisees hit upon as a way of displaying their meticulous cleanliness. And this apparently impressed other people because they took it up. It became one of the traditions, one of the customs. And in the course of time, as usually happens, this tradition by the Pharisees became, at least by themselves, regarded as law. So easy to make your traditions the law for somebody else. It's one of the big dangers that we run, isn't it? Even in religion today. It's so very easy to make our own traditions into laws. Now, there's nothing to stop me adopting a certain practice for myself, providing that it is not anti-scriptural, but it does become wrong when I make my custom or my tradition a law that's applicable to everybody. We've had in this country a great issue on the cup question in recent years, let's say in the last 25 years, or that's not so recent. And you know that there has been a great argument raging as to whether it should be one cup or whether it should only be individual cups. And there have been very, very clear lines of demarcations between the various camps on this. In some instances, but not always, some brethren have taken the strict line that unless you use one container for the Lord's Supper, you are behaving in an unscriptural fashion. Now, the brethren, as you very well know, assume that it's permissible to use individual cups. Others are somewhere in between, and they say that you may use two containers, or three containers, or four containers, whatever it is. Now, my own view on this, I was brought up using one container at Hindley, but I've reached the stage in my Christian experience when I recognize that the symbol of the blood of the Lord is the fruit of the vine, and the symbol of the body of the Lord is the unleavened bread. It's not the plate that holds the bread, it's not the vessel that contains the fruit of the vine. And with me, it's not a matter of principle, it's not something that I would argue with or disfellowship anybody about. My own practice is to use something that I've grown up with, that I've become accustomed to, that I've known all my life. I have no desire to change it. And I wouldn't force any change upon any brother. If I believed that it were essentially scriptural to use one vessel, I would fight tooth and nail for one vessel. If, on the other hand, I believe the scriptures taught we ought to use individual cups, I'd fight just as hard to use individual cups. But so long as the scripture doesn't attach any significance to that, then I'm not going to offend my Lord by creating division among my brethren by insisting on what has become my custom and my tradition. Wherever I go, I'll do what I believe is good for me and what I've grown up to do. And I'll hold that position until somebody else can show me something differently. On the other hand, we've had brethren who have come to a conclusion that for themselves this is right, and unfortunately, instead of holding their faith for themselves, they have tried to force it onto the conscience of others and try to compel others to conform to their practice, and that is where you're wrong. If anybody conforms to your practice simply to please you, and not out of conviction, you have gained absolutely nothing. Ali, yes.
I before having what you said, Steve, I mean, why does it seem that congregations who have started up in recent years and seem to use the individual containers?
Oh, well, I think there's a very simple reason for that. If you just think about it for a moment, you'll find that many of Corbett started up in recent years rather than using individual containers. I think you'll discover that where you've had an American evangelist working, that's where you've got American individual containers. It's as simple as that. Just as simple as that. And yes, it really is.
Well, there's not a congregation in Ireland.
At the present time. But you don't forget the work in Ireland, the current work in Ireland began with American evangelists. You go to Berlin Street, they don't use one cup. They don't use individual cups. You'll find,
I could name you the American evangelists that started using Jack Exum, Clarence Ekman, Bill Tyner, what's the other fellow's name? There may only be one American evangelist at the present time, but the work, the modern work in Ireland, particularly Newton Hodge and these other places, began with American evangelists. There's no doubt at all about that. And it certainly is true in this country that the congregations that have been established from the other side of the water are the other congregations that use individual cups. Where a church has been established as the result of an American campaign, that's where it's happened. I'm not arguing against that at all. I mean, it's nothing that doesn't offend me or anything like that at all. I'm simply explaining what is a fact of life. That's the explanation. But I mean, this is not the issue. The issue is when we begin to make traditions. Let's face it, we've got our traditions in this country, just as they've got traditions in the United States. Three songs and a prayer, that's a scriptural practice in the United States. And Bible studies on Wednesday, Bible classes on Wednesday, that's the scriptural time to have your midweek Bible classes. We all have customs like this. I mean, we've got to guard against bringing what is a local practice and a local custom and insisting that that is the way that everybody else has to do it. Let's keep to the scriptures. But one of the great cries in this country and in the United States, the cry of the restoration movement, used to be, where the Bible speaks, we speak. Where the Bible is silent, we are silent. The tragedy is that we tend to speak where the Bible is silent. And that is the cause of most of our problems. And what has grieved me has been the ease with which people have gone into the business of dividing the body of Christ. And I don't think, for the life of me, brethren, that when I get to heaven, the Lord is going to decide whether to send me to heaven or to hell on whether or not I took the Lord's Supper out of one big cup or many little cups. I don't think that's an issue.
Don't we do it other ways? Not only a cup. We'll take the Sunday morning class here in Corbett a minute, and the teaching of the Holy Spirit. As far as I'm concerned, the teaching of the Holy Spirit is, your viewpoint on it, and that's all we're getting. There's a lot of us disagree with what you're teaching, but that viewpoint isn't being put across. So although we may not be only, as far as the cups are used, a lot of people believe what the Holy Spirit, because frankly, we're going to start it.
I would deny that, of course. I would deny that it's Frank Worgan's point of view. It is a point of view that Frank Worgan holds, but it's not my point of view. I'm vain enough to think that the point of view that I'm expressing is the point of view of the scriptures. And it's not a point of view that I've come to after being converted for 2 or 3 years. It's something that I've studied for the last 40 years. That does make a difference. Perhaps in 40 years' time, you'll be able to speak with as much confidence as I do, and have the right to do it. Okay? So that... Yes?
We're talking about the traditions. You're saying that on the day that you were judged, that you don't think the Lord will discern whether you use one cup or another. And I agree with you, but I think that there will be something said about what you told other people, and I'm not going to clarify myself. I think that, say, the person who says you're wrong for doing that, well, yeah, that's something to answer for. That person argues, beyond the need of arguing, will have something to say about it. Will have something said to him, or, of course, I don't understand what's going to go on, but I think that we watch out what we condemn and what we don't condemn, because it may come back and say that.
Well, I'm afraid you lost me somewhere along the line. I'm not quite sure that I know what you mean, David. Does anybody else know what he means? Is he? No? Well, try again, David. Go on, go through it. Run it one more time.
That when we are judged for our deeds,
yes,
what we do, that I agree with you, we'll not be judged whether we used one large cup or many little cups, but we will be judged if we condemn somebody who uses many little cups and make it a test and makes that a test of fellowship. And there are brothers that make a test of fellowship. There are brothers in the United States who make who think it's wrong to use one cup and make it a test of fellowship. And I think that is where we'll need to watch.
Yeah, well, that's, we're coming back to this. We're coming back to the business of dividing the body of Christ over. You know, we can have different views on a whole lot of things. I mean, Raymond disagrees with me on the Holy Spirit. I'd like Raymond to tell me why he disagrees with me one of these days. He's not yet done it. He's told me several times he disagrees with me, but he doesn't take the opportunity on Sunday morning to tell me. But we won't go into that just now.
That's got right. The last time I was told it was just brushed off.
By whom?
2 weeks ago when we talked about Mark 1:8, it was just...
Oh, I don't know that anybody was ever brushed off. Not really. Not really, no. But the point is, we can disagree on anything. You don't have to, I'm not infallible, you don't have to accept it because Frank Worgan says it. I don't want anybody to do that, and you won't do it. But if we ever get to the point where we decide to divide the body of Christ on these issues, then that's a tremendous responsibility. I don't think that my salvation depends upon what I regard, what I think about individual cups. I don't. There are lots of things in the religious life that are not matters that will affect your salvation one way or another. Whether you have, there are some brethren who think we should have the Lord's Supper in the evening and not in the morning. There are some brethren who believe we should meet in an upper room, as they did in New Testament times. That's precisely the reason why you've been to Albert Street, haven't you? Many of you, in Wigan.
Oh,
well, what was unpleasant about that?
Before you walk out of the building.
I'm talking about the building. You've been to the building. The reason why they have that upper room is that when those buildings were put up, that's there, and at Liversedge in Yorkshire and certain other places, the brethren built the meeting place upstairs, and Bible class room downstairs. The idea was that the brethren met in an upper room, and that's what they're doing. Now, I'm not saying that this is held to today, and I would imagine that many of the brethren at Albert Street today have forgotten if they ever knew that that was the reason for the original design of their building. But they never, even in those days, they never made it a test of fellowship. There are many, many things that we can do that become our traditions, and what we really do need to guard against is causing anybody to lose his soul by insisting that people conform to a particular view. So with the Pharisees, there's nothing wrong with the Pharisees washing their hands as a matter of hygiene. And if they're so obsessed with this idea of cleanliness, there's nothing wrong with them washing their whole body, washing their hands. But when they seek to impose those laws on other people, that was the time when Jesus had something to say about it, and he talks about it here. In this particular passage, Mark 7, the Pharisees ask him, "Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with hands undefiled?" And Jesus accuses them of hypocrisy. Now, a hypocrite is one who acts a part. You remember that a hypocrite was one, literally, who acted behind a mask. In ancient times, the Greeks didn't have makeup and change their clothes when they acted. An actor would hold a little stick in his hand with a false face on it, and he would talk behind that. And the hypocrite was the actor, the one who acted a part behind a false face. And Jesus accuses these men of being hypocrites. Now, why are they hypocrites? Well, he says, Isaiah says of you, "This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching us doctrines, the precepts of men." So that fairly and squarely puts the practice of the Pharisees in its place, teaching us doctrines, the commandments of men. And Jesus says, "You leave the commandments of God and hold fast the tradition of men." Notice how. He says, "You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition." Now, Moses says, "Honor your father and mother."
Now, the law of Moses said that a man was responsible for looking after his parents, for taking care of his parents. But the Pharisees had devised a way around that. They had used that word korban, which means a gift. It is an offering. And they would say, now I know that the law says that it's my responsibility to look after my aged parents, but you see, I am dedicating my wealth to God. It is korban, it is offered to God. And therefore I can't take the money that I've offered to God and use it to look after my aged parents. And Jesus says, you are frustrating the law of Moses by a practice you yourselves have devised, by thinking that you can dedicate your possessions to God. You seek to escape from your responsibilities imposed on you by the law to your parents. And it's quite a thought, isn't it? He says, you make void the word of God through your tradition, which you hand on. And many such things you do. Jesus says this is not the only thing. Now, this discussion had begun with that very critical question about eating with the hands unwashed. And Jesus sees that this is too important a subject to drop, and he comes back to it in Matthew chapter 14, verse 15. Look at this again. We've got the right one. We've got the right chapter here. And I've got the wrong... Just a minute. I've got the wrong passage. No, it's what I'm talking about. It's verses 14 and 15 of Mark 6. He calls the people to him again and says to them, hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a man which by going into him can defile him, but the things which come out of a man are what defile him. Now, this is expanded. Pardon? This is in Mark 6. Mark 7, rather, 14 and 15. This is where Jesus returns to this question. He deliberately calls the crowd to him and exposes the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. And he looks on their teaching as so destructive that he has to say something about it to the people. Now, Jesus doesn't mean when he says here there is nothing going into a man that can defile him. He's not meaning that they're not to observe the Levitical laws concerning meats that are clean and meats that are unclean. He doesn't mean to teach them that it's now permissible for them as Jews living under the law of Moses to eat pork and all the other meats forbidden by the law. But he is saying that the evil that comes out of a man, out of a man's mouth particularly, is far greater than the evil committed by the eating of anything that may be ritualistically unclean. Because he says, out of the man, out of the heart of a man, from the mouth come forth evil thoughts, blasphemies, and so on. And really, this is what it's all about. It's what you are inside that matters. Any thoughts on that? Observations? Well, this is really it. Well, the tongue is motivated by the heart anyway. If you don't think it, first of all, you're not going to say it. And that's why Jesus, in that Sermon on the Mount, condemned not only the action, but he condemned the spirit that prompts the action. That when he says, for example, with regards to adultery, he says the law says you mustn't commit adultery. But I say to you, if you look on a woman with that desire, you've already committed adultery in your heart. Because it's the heart where all of these things proceed from. If the bad temper's not inside, it won't express itself in my words. If the violence isn't in my heart, it won't express itself in action. If the immorality is not inside, it won't express itself in immoral action. So Jesus not only corrects the deed, but he prevents the evil deed by putting right the attitude. Out of the heart proceed these things. Now in verse 17, you'll notice that the disciples ask Jesus for an explanation. He says, don't you understand that whatever goes into a man from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and so passes on? And by the way, notice this remarkable parenthesis. Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, what comes out of a man's... A man is what defiles a man, for from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within, and they defile a man. Now, the great tragedy of the Pharisees' religion was that it paid so much attention to outward form. Providing you went through the right motions at the right time, you did the right thing in the right way, then everything was fine. And they didn't concern themselves about the inner condition of a man's heart. That's why Jesus called them whited sepulchres on one occasion. Whited sepulchres, he said, outwardly you look all right, but inwardly you're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Now, the Pharisees as a class... the Pharisees' own making. And that's why he calls them fools, unwise, hypocrites. Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, fornications, all kinds of... What's that passage that says, guard thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. And while it's good for us to do the right thing in the right way, we've got to have the right motive. We've got to have the right attitude. Now let's pass on, because there's something that I think is very important that I think we want to look at, and that is one of the climaxes of the ministry of Jesus, and that has to do with the confession of Peter at Caesarea Philippi. I'm not going to deal with the several miracles that occur after the speaking of these words by Jesus. He heals, for example, the daughter of the Syrophoenician woman. He heals a blind man. But I want us to come to the passage recorded in Matthew 16 that we know so well. Matthew 16, 13 to 20. This is the passage we usually take when we're talking about the confession of Peter. That's when Jesus comes to the coasts of Caesarea Philippi. That's verse 13. That's the most northerly point at which Jesus ever came. That's up here. He never got any farther north than this, which is about 20, 22 miles from Capernaum. This incident isn't just recorded in Matthew. It's recorded in Luke 19 and in Mark 8. And I think it might be well for us to look at those two passages, first of all, because they're not passages we normally turn to in thinking about Peter's confession. Let's look at Mark 8 to begin with. Mark 8, verses 27 to 30. Mark 8, 27 to 30. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked the disciples, who do men say that I am? And they told him, John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets. But he asked them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered him, you are the Christ. And he charged them to tell no one about him. Now, the account also given by Luke in Luke chapter 9 is
equally brief, or fairly brief anyway, Luke 9, beginning at verse 28. Is that the one I'm looking at? It's Luke 19. What, Luke 19, isn't it? Luke 19, I'm sorry. Luke 19, 18 to 21.
That's
right, I'm sorry. It's Monday morning. Yes, it is 9:18. Now it happened that as he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he asked them, "Who do the people say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others one of the old prophets has risen." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." But he charged them and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day rise again." Now this is expanded quite considerably in Matthew 16, as you very well know, beginning at that 13th verse. They've come to the district of Caesarea Philippi. It's really a city built by Herod in honor of Caesar, and he asks his disciples the same question: "Who do men say that the Son of Man is?" The answer is, there's one extra name pushed into Matthew's account. Do you spot it? Jeremiah. Why Jeremiah? Well, now, you know, we could think of John the Baptist, because obviously Herod thinks that John the Baptist may have risen from the dead, and that has gained some currency, some credence. Elijah, well, of course, you've only got to go back to the Old Testament to find that the scripture said that Elijah would come before the Messiah came. What about Jeremiah? Why Jeremiah? You know, there was a time, and yes, there was a time indeed, when Jeremiah was regarded as the chief of the prophets. Somehow he seems to have been relegated to a lower position. In modern times, we don't think of Jeremiah as being one of the leading prophets, but there's no doubt at all about it that the Jews had worked up some amazing stories with regards to Jeremiah. You remember that the last we saw of Jeremiah in the Old Testament was when he was being taken along with some fugitives to live in Egypt, when the rebels took refuge in Egypt from the wrath of Nebuchadnezzar after they had killed the governor whom he'd appointed to reign over Jerusalem. And so far as we know, Jeremiah lived and died in Egypt. The rest of his life he spent in Egypt. Now the Jews have a theory that he came back and lived for another 200 years, and they've all kinds of theories concerning Jeremiah. At least they did at one time in their history. And no doubt this is why Jeremiah is mentioned here as being one of the foremost prophets. But Jesus saying in effect, "Now look, you've been with me for so long, over 2 years, you've heard my teaching, you've seen my miracles, and you know what's been going on. What are people saying about me? What is the popular view?" And then he gets these answers. But then he brings the question home. He says, "Now you've had a better opportunity of getting to know the truth than they have. What's your view?" And in each one of these narratives, you must have noticed it was Peter who responded, "Thou art the Christ," or "Thou art the Christ of God." And here, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." That expression, "the Son of the living God," is added in Matthew's account here. "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now the significance of this answer is that the teaching of Jesus and the miracles of Jesus have produced the effect that Jesus has wanted. Remember that he's taken these men with him to be trained and prepared for their own work when he leaves them. He has reached the point where he has convinced them of his messiahship and his deity. Don't forget that. And this is why, from this point on, Jesus begins to talk to them concerning the death that he will accomplish at Jerusalem. This is one of the climaxes in his ministry, when he gets Peter to confess the thing that needs to be confessed, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God.
And you'll notice he says, blessed art thou, Simon, son of John, for flesh and blood hath not revealed this to thee, but my Father who is in heaven. In other words, this is not simply a conclusion to which you've come yourself. It is a divine revelation. My Father's helped you to see this. And when you think of the confession of Peter, it's a tremendous one. I don't think we stop to think about this. What is implied in thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God? If that's true, what does it mean?
His deity.
It means his deity, certainly. It means that Jesus, as the Messiah, is the Savior. It means, too, that if he is the Son of God, as Gee says, everything he commands has to be obeyed. It means that if that is true, Jesus has the right to the allegiance and the obedience of everyone who understands the gospel. That every command that Jesus issues has to be obeyed. That he can never take an inferior place in anybody's life. So that if you accept that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, that is fundamental to the Christian faith. And that's exactly why Jesus said, upon this rock I will build my church. If a person doesn't have that basic faith in Jesus, he cannot become a Christian. And it's because this is the foundation of the faith of every Christian, that it's the faith of the whole church. It's the foundation on which the church is built. That's why Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church. On the fact that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. We don't have to go into a discussion at this point of what the Roman Catholic Church believes about Peter. I think we're all well aware of that, this idea of the papacy of Peter, the supremacy of Peter. It's not taught in that passage at all. It's simply play on words. You are a stone, but on this rock, the truth that you've uttered, I will build my church. The church will be built on the fact that I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that's why anybody who's not fully convinced in his heart that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and is not prepared to accept the consequences of such a confession, can't be a Christian. And it's one reason why we need to be very careful in teaching people. Really, this is what they need to know. I very often say, before baptizing people, before we baptize this person, there's simply one question we need to ask. Only one question we're authorized to ask. And that is, do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God? Or that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? You don't have to ask them, do you believe the Church of Christ is right? Or do you believe that the kingdom's already been set up? Or a thousand and one other things? You can't go adding to this and making demands that the scriptures don't make. The only question you have a right to ask of any person who seeks to obey the gospel is, do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God? With all that's involved in that statement, and all that such a confession involves. Because after all, there's a learning that goes on after that, isn't there? You know, sometimes we expect people to know too much before they become Christians. We haven't the right. There's a teaching that goes on after a person has confessed his faith in Jesus. So here we find Peter making this confession, and notice, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now, has this anything to do with the power of a priest to forgive sins? What does it mean? What does it mean? Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Anybody any idea?
Acts 2.
Well, explain what you mean there, Rick.
On the day of Pentecost, when they asked what the name of Jesus was saved, he turned around and told them, so therefore it was the case that one had under the kingdom, and that was the only way that one could get into the kingdom. There's no other way.
What it's actually saying is, what the passage really means is, not that Peter had the right to make a statement and heaven would turn around and say, oh, Peter said that, so we better endorse it. The statement that Peter made had already been endorsed in heaven. All that Peter did was to make a statement of which heaven had already approved. And it simply means that Peter and the others would be enabled to make known the law according to which sins would be forgiven. And once that law had been obeyed, heaven would recognize that obedience and the sins would be forgiven. It's interesting to notice, for example, in Matthew 18, also, if I can find this verse again, where Jesus is speaking to the disciples, and where are we? Whosoever sins ye remit, they are remitted. Whosoever sins ye retain, they are retained. Where is that passage? It's in Matthew 18 for just a moment. That's a passage that's also brought up, you see, in this connection. Whosoever sins ye remit, they are remitted. Whosoever sins ye retain, they are retained. But it's really what Raymond has been saying. But when Peter made known the terms of salvation, those who responded to the terms of salvation had their sins remitted. But the law that showed people how their sins would be forgiven was also the law in the other direction that bound their sins on the mission.
Matthew 18, isn't it?
I thought it was. Truly I say unto you, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. The reason for me raising this verse, and at the back of my mind it was Matthew 18:18, but the reason is that what Jesus says to Peter in Matthew 16, he says to the whole disciples in Matthew 18. So this was not power just given to Peter alone, but it was given to the whole of the 12, simply because they were the ones to make known the law according to which sins would be forgiven. Okay? And I think we'll finish at that, because we need to look at our next study at the Transfiguration, because that's another of the great climaxes in the ministry of Jesus. I'll tell you what, it's hard getting back into this business after being on holiday. Well, I guess you're right there. I guess you're right, really.
Yes, sir. Right. See where it says there, and the powers of death will not fulfill again.
Yeah.
Would it be true to say, you know, when people talk of the church, if we know the church of Christ, they talk about the restoration movement, God of Alexander Campbell, would it not be true to have that passage? There must always be the church has been in existence from the Ben R. Craig over.
I believe so. I don't go too much for the restoration movement argument. I'm not interested. I'm not a member of a restoration movement. I'm a member of the Lord's body. I'm a member of a church that began long before Alexander Campbell ever appeared on the scene. And I think too much has been made of the restoration movement. The movement to restore has been a movement ever since Calvary, when the Lord has been seeking to restore men to himself. And I believe too that the church has always been in existence. So long as the Word of God has existed, there has been the possibility of men coming to the knowledge of the truth and becoming children of God. Now that verse, and the gates of hell shall not, or the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it, is often misunderstood. Sometimes the picture is given of the church bursting forth out of hell. The church has never been in hell, and the church won't be in hell. That's not to the, and it's, on the other hand, it's not a picture of the church attacking hell and the gates of hell not being able to withstand the onslaught of the church, because the church doesn't want to capture hell. The church doesn't want to get into hell. It's Hades, the place of the dead, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. What Jesus is saying, because I am the Christ, the Son of God, I shall die, but I shall rise again in triumph from the dead. And my death is the guarantee of the resurrection of everyone who believes in me. That's what Jesus is saying there. Jesus is saying the gates of Hades shall not hold in the church, but the church will rise in triumph because I rise. That's the meaning of the verse. Okay, then we'll leave it there. We looked on Monday
at the feeding of the 5,000 and the crossing of the Sea of Galilee, and then we saw that when Jesus arrived on the coast here, he had the controversy with the scribes and Pharisees on the question of eating with unwashed hands. And there, and this is important to notice, there the Galilean ministry effectively ended. Because after that time, Jesus left Jewish territory for only the second time in his life. I don't know if you've ever stopped to consider this, but you have, every one of you no doubt, have travelled vastly greater distances than Jesus ever travelled in his whole life. You know, it's an amazing thought, isn't it? That every one of you have travelled far more miles, as far as distance is concerned, than Jesus ever did in the whole of his life. Even if you only went from here up to Peterhead, you've travelled a greater distance than Jesus ever travelled. Only twice did he ever leave Jewish territory, and you remember when they were. The first time when?
Egypt.
When he went down to Egypt as a baby. I'm not thinking of Samaria. The Jews would actually claim Samaria as their territory. You know, they would think that the Samaritans were occupying it wrongly. The other time was when he went up north, and we'll be looking briefly at this today, up to Tyre. That's after the feeding of the 5,000. You remember that he came across here, landed on this side on the plain here, and then from here, as we're going to see, he went up to Tyre and made a sweeping journey around, coming down here to Decapolis again and spending a short time in Decapolis. And that, as I say, effectively ended the ministry, the Galilean ministry of Jesus. Let's turn to Matthew 21, and I'll show you what I'm talking about. Matthew 15, rather, verse 21. Now you'll notice that the last verse, verse 20, is the verse where Jesus says, "The things that defile a man are these terrible things of which he has been speaking, but to eat with unwashed hands doesn't defile him." And then the next verse, Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. The reason for this, it would seem to me, is there had been some hostility already in existence, and further hostility was created by the statement that Jesus had made concerning the unwashed hands. But he withdrew. That's the idea. He drew himself away. As I say, his ministry in Galilee has ended, and so he goes up to the region of Tyre and Sidon. If you turn to chapter 7 of the Gospel according to Mark, and verse 31, you'll see another relevant verse here. Mark 7 and verse 31. You'll find that this is at the end of his visit to Tyre and Sidon, where he has healed the daughter of a Syrophoenician woman. And then verse 31 says, "Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee." So that means the sweeping journey. Here is Sidon up here, see. He made a sweeping journey down this way back to the coast of Galilee.
Excuse me.
Yes.
The last one there, how does Mark,
yes, I know that. I'm coming back. I'm building up to the climactic events. What I'm trying to show you is that Peter's confession is at the climax of this Galilean ministry. I'm going to mention that just a moment. I'm covering a bit of the ground we went over on Monday. Okay, it's a sort of review, because remember we discussed the feeding of the 5,000. We talked in detail about the crossing of the sea. We talked about the eating with unwashed hands. Then Jesus goes up north. He goes up to Sidon. There he has a visit in the home of a Syrophoenician woman, which we did not talk about because it's not something that we need to spend too much time on. That visit, as I was just saying, to Tyre and Sidon was simply his withdrawal from Galilee, signifying the ending of that ministry. And then he returns to Decapolis.
He feeds 4,000, which we didn't talk about either. There are one or two cures, one or two healings, and then he passes on to Caesarea Philippi. That's the thing we did talk about. We mentioned the significance of the confession, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. I didn't spend any time speaking about the revelation concerning the church, because I didn't think you needed it. What I'm having to do in this study, and it's one that I don't particularly enjoy, is to select certain things that I think are important. We wouldn't finish the study of the synoptics before the end of June if we went into all of this in detail. So it's a question simply of touching on certain events in the life of Jesus and trying to build up a general picture of how that ministry went. I didn't discuss the feeding of the 4,000 that occurs in Matthew chapter 15. You might sometime want to make a comparison of those two healings in virtually successive chapters, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, and you might find for yourselves the reasons why you can't agree with those people who tell you that they're simply a repetition of the same miracle. There are some fundamental differences, as anybody with only half an eye can see. But as we've so often seen with the critics, if they want to find fault with a miracle or any event in the life of Jesus, they simply take the easy way, and they just say this is that, or this is something else, and they don't accept what's stated. You compare the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000, you'll find they're different in the place, in the time, in the numbers, in the results, and in where Jesus finally ended up after the miracles. But I won't spend any more time on that. Leave that just there. We've passed on to Caesarea Philippi. We've heard Peter's confession. We've heard the great pronouncement of Jesus concerning the church. Upon this rock I will build my church. The only thing I will say there, and again I think this ought to be superfluous for you, is that that's the first time that Jesus ever speaks about the church. There in Matthew 16, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. I think if I remember rightly, Raymond raised that question of the gates of Hades right at the end of the study, didn't you? When we virtually closed it, and I pointed out what it means. That it doesn't mean that the church is going to take hell captive, or that the church is going to break out of hell in that sense. But it means that the gates of the unseen world, the gates of the place of the dead, will not hold in the church, because Jesus, being the Christ, the Son of the living God, will die only to rise again. That is to say that the victory of Jesus over death and the grave is the guarantee of the resurrection of every child of God. That's the importance of that statement. The gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Now, after that, after the confession by Peter, we move on to the next great event that I want us to talk about, and that is the Transfiguration. Because this took place within 8 days of the confession of Peter at Caesarea Philippi. Remember that the confession of Peter at Caesarea Philippi was the climax of that part of his ministry. This is proved by Matthew 16 and verse 21. Matthew 16, verse 21. From that time began Jesus to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. Now, understand that this is where Jesus has been leading the disciples. He's been leading them to a realization of his own identity. They, perhaps above all others, need to be absolutely convinced who Jesus is. And all of their training, all of the teaching, all of the works that have gone on in their presence have been designed to convince them of the fact that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Right at the very beginning we said that the Gospel according to Matthew really contained a series of 5 discourses. You remember that? The first one was the Sermon on the Mount. The second was the instruction given by Jesus, Sermon on the Mount chapters 5 to 7. The Sermon on the Mount, and then followed by the instruction given by Jesus to his apostles in chapter 10.
And then in chapter 13, instruction concerning the kingdom and the seven parables of the kingdom. And then in chapter 18, instruction concerning forgiveness, the law that's to operate in the church. The second time the word church is mentioned, Matthew 18. And then finally, the instruction concerning the end of all things in chapters 23 to 25. Now, when you think about it, you'll realize that all five of those discourses related to believers, to disciples. The Sermon on the Mount was the law that was to operate inside the kingdom. The instruction to the apostles, preparing them for the ministry. Instruction concerning the kingdom, the nature of the kingdom. Instruction concerning love, behavior in the kingdom. Instruction concerning final things, the hope and the destiny of the kingdom. All of these things have to do with believers. But once the disciples have become convinced that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, Jesus is able to turn away. His ministry designed to convince men of that fact is completed, the witness is over, and he begins to set his face towards Jerusalem. That's the meaning of the verse there in that particular chapter. From that time began Jesus to show his disciples, and that is the first clear revelation from Jesus about his forthcoming death. Now, as I say, the next thing we look at is the transfiguration. And that, according to Matthew 17, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John his brother, and led them up into a high mountain apart. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his garments became white as light. Behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Peter said to him, Lord, it is well that we are here. If you wish, I will make 3 booths here, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. He was still speaking when, lo, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were filled with awe. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, rise and have no fear. And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. That word transfiguration, can anybody tell me what it comes from? That's right. That's the point. It comes from the Greek word metamorpho. And you know what? Let's put it like that. That's what it's actually. It's a long row, actually. You know that a caterpillar goes through that metamorphosis, a change. This is from the Greek. Our word transfiguration is of Latin origin, but the word that is used there is metamorpho, and we get it from that. Is it the 9th verse? No, not the 9th verse. Verse 2, rather. He was transfigured before them, and his face shone. Now, let's think for a little while about this event, because it is a most important event, a very significant event. What are the details? Well, can we locate the mountain of the Transfiguration? Well, some people think we can. Grant is smiling. Some people think that it's Mount Tabor. It should be, there's Mount Tabor here, on the plain of Esdraelon. And there's no doubt at all, Tabor is a very striking mountain. It rises very dramatically out of the plain of Esdraelon. You probably know that this area has really been a cockpit in which the nations fought over and over again, time and time again, being as it was on the main road from Egypt to Mesopotamia, to the east. This is quite often, this great plain is where the arm is quite often met. And here you have Mount Tabor. From Mount Tabor you can look right across and you can see the hill of Megiddo. You remember the conflicts that took place on the plain of Megiddo. Harmageddon, the valley of Megiddo, the great area in which battles
have been fought ever since the time of Barak and the judges. And it is a very striking mountain. It's round like that. It's remarkable. It has a uniform shape, and from virtually whichever side you look at it, that's how it seems. You know, and you have the plain, and right at the edge here, near the Sea of Galilee, you have this almost like a sugar loaf mountain, a round mountain. Pardon? How did it? Well, I suppose it arose because Mark's version says after 6 days he came to this place, and they say, well, you know, you could work in a 6 day journey from Caesarea Philippi down to Mount Tabor, but that of course is assuming that Jesus was walking all the time. It's not necessary to assume that. There are certain reasons why I don't think that it's Mount Tabor, why it's unlikely. You'll notice that Matthew here says he led them into a high mountain. Now, by no stretch of imagination could you call Mount Tabor a high mountain. And again, at that particular time, Mount Tabor was very likely fortified. There was a fortress up there. Many, many great events have taken place on Mount Tabor in the past. But if there was a garrison station there, it's highly unlikely that Jesus would have gone there for the transfiguration. And there's furthermore, if you look at Mark 9 and verse 30, I think you'll discover that when Jesus had finished that ministry that I talked about, he avoided Galilee after that. Notice, they went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he would not have anyone know it, for he was teaching his disciples and saying to them, the Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men. As I say, the ministry is over. He's now concerned about his forthcoming death, which simply means that he kept away from the well-populated areas. Now, what's the alternative if it's not Tabor? That is the only truly high mountain in the whole of Palestine. It's excuse me, this is drying my throat. It's at least 10,000 feet high, and Mount Hermon is the only mountain in the whole of Palestine that has snow on it all the year round. Now, it was about 14 miles from Caesarea Philippi. I don't know what Jesus did in the intervening time, but I don't think it's necessary for me to know what he did every day. All that we're simply told here is that after 6 days, or 8 days, within 8 days, Jesus came to this place for the Transfiguration. Now, what actually happened at the Transfiguration? Well, if you go back to that passage again, you find that two things happened. Something was done to his appearance by God. The passive form of the verb that is used there, he was transfigured before them, indicates that this was something done to him. It wasn't something that he did himself. It was an experience that was granted to him. It wasn't like a spotlight focused on him, shining on him, because you'll notice that his face shone first. His face shone like the sun. That's right at the very beginning of that chapter, verse 2. There was a light from within, almost. And then his garment shone next. His garments became white as light, white and glistering, says Mark. Mark has a rather homely note there. He says, white as no fuller on earth could whiten them. So here you have, first of all, the inner transformation that causes the very person of Jesus to radiate. And then you have this transformation of his very garments. Well, it seems to affect them. His garments also begin to glow. They're white and glistening. All that I can think of is that here you have one of those examples again where the majesty of the true nature of Jesus shone through. You know very well that all the time, even though he was in an earthly body, he was nevertheless the Son of God. He was deity. He was God clothed with flesh. Now how the human body could contain deity is something quite beyond me to understand. And yet, in some way, Jesus, whilst being the Son of God, limited himself. He laid aside his glory. There's a passage that says that, isn't there? You had it in John. Father, glorify thou me with the glory that I had with thee before the worlds were framed. John 17. So the glory of Jesus was laid aside, as it were, or at least subdued. And yet, it would appear that on occasions, even during the earthly ministry of Jesus, this majesty, this effulgence shone through. It was impossible for this body of flesh to contain the majesty. And that example there in the Garden of Gethsemane, well, outside of the garden, because Jesus went outside when he heard them coming. He didn't meet them inside the garden. And we're told that he said to them, who are you looking for? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. What did he say? Did he come up? Did you study this in John? What was the answer Jesus gave? Whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, I am, ego eimi. Now the word he is in italics. I am. The very words which are used in the Septuagint version as expressing the name of God. I am. And we're told that when he said that, they fell backward to the ground and became virtually as dead men. What happened? He never touched them. It was almost as if you had a flash of the divine glory that belonged to him when he spoke the name that expressed deity and identified himself with deity. I am. Why, you know, whenever I read that, excites me, because whenever I read that, it makes me realize that Jesus wasn't taken finally by the hands of wicked men at their will and crucified. They didn't kill him simply because he was the unfortunate victim who couldn't escape them. He simply surrendered himself to men who in no way could have touched him if he hadn't been willing to die. It was, in every possible sense of the word, a voluntary death. And here again, on the mount, he is transfigured. Some of his natural glory shines through. And it's not surprising that the disciples here are overpowered. They fall on their faces and they're filled with awe. They just can't stand in the presence of Jesus. Pardon? Well, this is a thing I want to come on. I want to come on to that just one moment before we actually come to the purpose, the fact itself, and the things that were said. Then we'll look at the significance of the transfiguration. If you just sort of bear with me for a moment, David. So then, have you ever thought what when it happened? What did it happen in the night time or the daytime? We'll have a look at Luke chapter 9 and verse 32. Maybe just a little incident, a curious incident. Luke chapter 9, verse 32. And just stay in Luke for just a moment. Now what does that suggest to you? It suggests that it might have been night, huh? An afternoon nap. Well, if you think it might possibly have been an afternoon nap, look at verse 28 of that same passage, the last sentence. Jesus went up on the mountain to pray. Now, Jesus didn't normally take the afternoon for praying. We're told that he was, during the day, he was teaching the people, and at night he was on the mountain praying. So this would suggest to me that the Mount of Transfiguration, at least to begin with, was a night scene. There's another thought, too. If you look at verse 30,
7 of that same passage, on the next day when they had come down from the mountain, or when they came down from the mountain, it is almost as if they spent the night on the mountain. But they went up, Jesus went up there to pray, and in the course of his prayer, it's almost like the Garden of Gethsemane, isn't it, when you think of it? The Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus goes in to pray, and the disciples are overpowered with sleep. Here on the mountain, Jesus goes to the mountain to pray. The disciples are their eyes are heavy with sleep, you remember? And Jesus, they're awakened to this tremendous scene that takes place before them with Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus on the mountain. How do they recognize Moses and Elijah?
Lapel badges.
What's that, Ian? Big signs. Or perhaps caps with I am Elijah or I am Moses. Or do you suppose that Peter and James and John had identikit pictures or mug shots? Let's see, that one on the left must be Elijah and that one on the right must... No. It's just a thought. I mean, we're laughing at it. We're making a joke of it. But how did it happen? Absolutely, absolutely. There was some divine intuition, clearly. And one thing this also suggests to me, evidently when Moses and Elijah died in the afterworld, they weren't turned out like peas out of a pod, all looking alike. Yes, Remy?
We saw a little there in 9:30, Peter not knowing what he said.
That's right, that's all big mouth once again, isn't it, really, when you think of it? But I'll come to that in just a moment, what Peter said and what God said. Raymond, it's nice to have friends. It's nice to have friends, never mind that. Peter said, Lord, it is good for us to be here. Let us build three tabernacles, one for thee, one for... And he did not know what he said. In fact, two of the writers tell you that Peter spoke impetuously like that. You'll find that both Mark and Luke tell you that Peter didn't know what he was saying, but he was overcome by the occasion. I could understand this too, that he would be overcome by the occasion. But what was the point I was going to make just then? You're getting me going. Yes, I asked you a question, didn't I? You get me as confused as you are.
Do you want to do the spot test first?
Yeah, would you like the spot test now while I gather my thoughts together about this? What was I thinking about? Never chokes off zeal or enthusiasm like that. He recognized what was in Peter's heart, and that's why Jesus said to Peter, come. And again, don't forget that Jesus issued that invitation. And if the Lord had not bid Peter come to him, Peter wouldn't have tried it. And the Lord never invites anybody into danger. And he never invites anybody to expose himself to risk. And whenever you find Jesus encouraging anybody, it's because it can be accomplished. You never find him encouraging anybody to try the impossible. On the contrary, whenever Jesus sees anything in our lives that's good and worthy and noble, he draws it out. He encourages it. He strengthens it, and he sees the faith and the love in the heart of Peter, and he wants to encourage that, to draw it out, to get Peter to express it. And I believe it was like that too, so that you don't find a rebuke for Peter here later on when they're both in the boat with the others. And I've no doubt that Peter's very full of disappointment because he'd failed in that way. Jesus didn't rebuke him for asking to be allowed to step over the side of the boat.
Jesus didn't say to him, "Now, I hope you've learned your lesson." No, he said, "Oh, ye of little faith, why did you doubt?" I can see the tenderness and the love in the eyes of Jesus as he speaks to Peter. He's saying, "Peter, you could have done it. You could have made it. Why did you doubt?" Just how do you think Jesus looked on Peter's attempt at that time? Well, if you have children, and some of you have children of your own, and some of you will have your own children eventually, I'm sure you can all understand how parents feel about their own children. You know, when you see that baby crawling around the room, and eventually it gets up and it holds onto the couch or the chair, you know, and they desperately anxious to, you know what I mean, don't you? But what do? You say, come on, and you hold your hands out, and you're delighted, aren't you? It's a tremendous thrill for any parent to see the child make the first feeble steps. All right, okay, good. But you see, right? At least now John has the privilege. Well, I think that's exactly how Jesus saw it when Peter was wanting to step over the side and walk to him. What else but love and faith would have put this idea into Peter's mind? And Jesus was encouraging the steps of faith on this occasion. Right, like the parent holding out his arms to the hesitant child. Like, come on, you come, you can do it. Again, would you have tried it? Honestly, I've thought about this a great deal from time to time, and I don't know that I would have even wanted to try it, and at least I have got to give Peter the credit for having this tremendous faith in Jesus. So whenever you read this story about Peter wanting to walk on the sea, don't look upon it as a warning against rashness or lack of faith. It's anything but that. Peter's impulse was good,